tell you about the destruction of all the evil that will have to end.
That's the Queen herself, Nina Simone, with Revolution. It's from her 1969 album, To Love Somebody. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead, and we're going a little bit historical today, looking at, in fact, it's an extension of an article of a discussion we began earlier in the week. Late last week. It's about transitions and how we manage to miss very often the gifts and the opportunity that we have right before us. And this one is political. It is Shirley Chisholm. We're looking at Shirley Chisholm today at a very key point in her life in 1972 when she ran for the presidency and caused quite a stir. It is a significant moment because it is the time when the country is being tested in many, many ways. In her case, here is the first African-American woman from a major party running for the position and bringing to a head a number of other issues that managed to course their way into her campaign. Obviously, she was an African-American. Obviously, she was a woman. But beyond all of that, you have several layers of stories under her candidacy. And what I wanted to share with you today is her own story about this position that she was in, trying to run for president of the United States. And she gives a look from the inside, both personally and career-wise, and of course politically, about life, how she had to cope with things that she never expected to cope with, but with some profound observations about life and how she had to live it to the point where she was. This is a speech she made at UCLA, California, and she's discussing these barriers that she had to overcome in life, in her profession, and in her political career. She was, by the way, an educator, among everything else. But she also talks about why voters should take a different attitude to political involvement and why political parties themselves share the blame for a declined interest in politics. When you listen to what she's saying, you know, you might as well believe that she's talking today. And this, to remind you, was 1972. There were many things, very nuanced, but I found identification with. I'm not suggesting that Shirley Chisholm was the ideal and perfect candidate. Even she wouldn't suggest that. But it is a story that we haven't really heard, not at this level, a person speaking for herself about her experiences in the United States. So with that, I present Shirley Chisholm.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our program. Today, we're delighted to have with us Shirley Chisholm, candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. She's the first black woman to be elected to Congress, and parenthetically, there are only 10 blacks in Congress, an institution that labels itself representative. Ms. Chisholm is an advocate of such reforms as volunteer army, lessening of the penalties for possession of marijuana, and equalization of rights for women. Ms. Chisholm has proven to be a progressive mind in an institution replete with antiquities. Would you please give a warm welcome to Shirley Chisholm?
Testing, yes. Students, I'm very glad to be here this afternoon. And by now, all of you know why I am in the state of California. But let me go back 7 months ago and try to come right up to date. About 7 months ago, a large number of persons in this country crossing sex lines, color lines, and ideological lines asked me to consider seriously making a bid for the presidency of the United States of America. And in the very beginning, I laughed because I was cognizant of the fact that being simultaneously a black person and a woman placed me in the position of being a part of two segments in America who have never had any real roles to play in terms of the decision-making processes and policies that govern our lives. And I indicated to many of these people that if indeed they were serious, it was very necessary for them to go back and do at least two things to make me feel that it was not really just a little game or it was not really a plan to flatter my vanity. And that was that they had to go back and to start to raise monies for me to enter some of the primaries, supplemented by putting together mechanisms for the distribution of literature and for carrying my message to the people in this country. And I found that within 5 weeks' time, in 25 states of this country, that people were serious about Shirley Chisholm making a bid for the presidency because they did not want to play politics as usual. They did not want to continue to make a selection between the lesser of the two evils. They didn't want to pull the lever beside the names of those individuals who have been a part of the national leadership team in this country for the past 8 years and has brought this country to the malaise in which it finds itself. But they wanted to pull the lever beside the name of somebody that would bring new input, would bring a new circulation in the bloodstream of this country, somebody who does not equivocate, and yes, somebody who has morality and an integrity of purpose in the political arena. And I said, yes, I would run. I would run realizing all of the controversies that would swirl about my head. But when you are a catalyst for change in any society, you have to be prepared to take the insults, the abuses, the misapprehensions, the skeptics, those who are not ready for change. You have to be prepared to take all of these kinds of situations that would immediately develop when you go against a tradition in this country, a tradition that has said ever since the inception of the Republic that only one segment of America can run and hope to aspire to be the chief executive of this nation, and that is a white male. And not only in terms of the chief executive of this nation, but also in terms of vice presidents and heads of departments and heads of agencies and ambassadors and consular generals. You name it, and I'll tell it to you. Only one segment of America seems tacitly to be able to have the creativity, the input, and the ability to solve so many of the problems of this country. And yet we look at this country today and look at the mess that we are in. It is time for new blood. And as I've been traveling up and down this land, it is so interesting to see what has developed and what continues to develop. First of all, I am so sick and tired of hearing the question, Mrs. Chisholm, are you serious? Now, if I stood on my head, a lot of people would still not believe that I'm serious. I've been traveling up and down this country for 7 months, and I can tell you I'm not traveling for my health. I am traveling because they've told me in America that if indeed you are serious, you don't sit back like the reluctant dragon, expect somebody's going to give you the nomination. You get out and at least get to the American people in the highways, the byways, the villages, the towns, and the cities and say, hey, look, here I am. Look at me in terms of what I can do if I lead this nation. So I've been traveling. And even though I have been traveling, for people to still ask, are you serious, is an indication of the prescribed roles that this society has given to women and the prescribed role that this society has given to blacks. And here I come, a part of both of these prescribed roles, going out here saying I'm running for the presidency of this country. Now, this country's in a mess. And we better get off this sex hang-up that we have. I've traveled a great deal, and I've never seen a place where people are so hung up on sex physically, psychologically, educationally, than in the good old USA. Now, this country, needs to rely more on humanism. This country needs the talents, the intellect, and the capabilities of human beings. We are all human beings, first of all. There are brilliant women in this country. There are brilliant men. There's stupid women and there's stupid men. There's no psychological test as yet that says one sex has the superiority of gray cranial matter over the other sex. The fact of the matter is we're allowing ourselves to be diverted from the course in this country. And that course is that we better get together and find out if we can't redirect the priorities in this nation to make this nation become the bulwark that it can truly become. And that is a haven for all kinds of peoples, regardless of race, color, creed, or sex. That's what we need to do in America today. I'm no ordinary woman running out here for president. Before I even went to the United States Congress, I knew I would be, have to be 2, 3, or 4 times as good as many of those gentlemen in the Congress because of who I am. I'm aware of double and triple standards, so I make sure that I fit the standards before I get out here. For over 15 years of my life, I have been writing projects and all kinds of proposals for gentlemen, both black and white. For over 15 years of my life in politics in the streets of New York, I have been the translator and interpreter as they would go around addressing the people because they could only speak English if they could handle that well. For over 15 years of my life, I have been the organizer of peoples to make them look good at city council hearings and budget estimate hearings. I'm a woman that holds 3 college degrees and 10 points for a PhD. I'm not here to boast to you, but I'm just a little bit sick and tired of people not looking at me in terms of my humanity and my capabilities. It is one thing for people to use the talents that you have. It is another thing to let you be the standard bearer. And that's why I'm out here. I knew I would get a lot of laughter and snide remarks, but I've always gotten that from the day I was born because I'm black. So I'm used to that. But the time has come in this country when if you keep talking about the American dream and the multifacetedness of this society, and you want to get this society together, you better begin to realize that it's time for new input even on the national level. Here I look at all of my opponents who are running with me to secure the nomination. Let's talk about them a little bit. all of these fine gentlemen, all of these senators, they have been in positions of power for quite some time, and in one way or another, with the exception of one gentleman, have been a part of what constituted a kind of national leadership in this country. They don't have any commitment to people. They have commitment to people every 4 years when it's time to get the vote. If they had a commitment to people and compassion and concern for the people in this country, why haven't they been able yet to do something about the Indians on the reservations of this country? Reservations where the land is barren and they cannot grow any kind of food to sustain and keep their bodies together. And yet this country belongs to the American Indian. And over 70% of the Indians on the reservations do not live to see the age of 40. Where have these voices been in terms of that? And then you get a token Indian on your staff and you're going to have a project for Indians when you get elected, because this is the way the politics in this country run. You get token people around you when you're going out on the national election to tell the people suddenly how great thou art and what you're going to do to save them. Fraud, sham, and hypocrisy. You take the Chicana people in the southwestern part of this country, in New Mexico and California and Texas, as I've been visiting with them and watching them. These people working sometimes 14 and 15 hours a day to put the fruits and the vegetables on our table so that we can eat well. And at the end of a week, they don't even get a decent salary to keep their families together. Where have these senators been? And now they go and get the endorsement of certain big Chicanas. Well, that's the way it's done. I'm not going to get endorsements of big Chicanas, big blacks, and what have you, because I'm too gutsy. I do not believe in the politics of expediency. That is why our country finds itself in the condition that it now finds itself. Nothing but expedient politics. And every 4 years we come out of our cobweb political holes and we get the Madison Avenue boys to put us together a little bit differently. We get the jingles and the slogans ready to flash across the screen in your bedrooms and living rooms at night. And you have the responsibility of deciding, after all of this is thrust upon you, which one of them you're going to vote for on June 6th. But if you don't want change, really, if you like how they do it every 4 years, and if you like the same warmed over, heated over, boiled over politicians coming back telling you they're going to save everybody, go and vote for them. But when they get in office, don't grumble. Don't grumble. I know too much about every one of them. I want to get in some public debates the worst way with them, because I know where every one of them are coming from. I'm sorry that I don't have a lot of money. One of them said if Shirley Chisholm had money, we would have to scurry for cover. You're darn right there would. The only thing I have out here is people who understand what I am doing and who have a commitment to me in terms of trying to bring about change within the system. Because so many young people told me as I was going on this trek, Chizzy, forget about it. You can't bring about any change within this system. Get out and lead a new movement. You have enough people in this country that see you as a new kind of national voice. Get out of the system. And I'm willing to tell these young people, give me a chance to try it this time. Come with me on the Chisholm Trail. Now look, either we want change or we like the idea about talking about change, you know? Because if we want change, we will give Mrs. Chisholm a chance I've never been to you before. But of course, if you have a hang-up because I am black and you're racist, you know, you can't handle that, because that tells something about the depths. If you have a hang-up, you're sexist because I'm a woman. The stage of my life, my bones are so fixed and what have you, I can't go to Denmark and get an operation. But if you have a hang-up because you have been disillusioned, fed up with politics as usual, business as usual, the same old baloney every 4 years, an American man or American woman can't even run for the presidency of this country if they really have ability, unless they have loads of monies behind them. Where is this country therefore going to get the creativity and the intellectual capacity and new innovative ideas unless we do something about the whole system of electing a president? To have people running for the presidency that do not even have to be too bright mentally or intellectually, but have the money to have the accessibility and availability to speech writers and the boys, putting them together and then having them come before you with the speech in front of them. God help them if they're outdoors and the wind blows that speech away. They can't even talk. But that is the way it is, young people in our country. That unless you have loads of money, that you can't even think of running for the presidency. To have traveled with them in Florida, in North Carolina, in Michigan, and watched them, sometimes going in before some of them and after some of them, to see how they can move from one issue to another issue and have 10 different positions in the same state. Dependent on the section of the state. No wonder people distrust our political leaders, because they do nothing but talk with forked tongue. A little bit about the issues, because I want to show you how they stand on issues. I want to show you how beautiful they evade a lot of things. In this country, we've had a war that's been going on now for 8 years. Over 50,000 lives have been lost. All kinds of military personnel and investigatory committees have come back and have said, this is a war that we cannot win. And over 65% of the American people have said, we want out. And yet, in spite of these reports, in spite of the representatives that we have to represent us on the legislative and executive level of this country, they pay absolutely no attention to us. And yet this is supposed to be government of the people, by the people, and for the people. So if that is supposed to be the case, what's happening? Haven't we said we want out? But you know, you can't get a chief executive to get you out unless you understand the nature of power in this country, which relegates the masses to the bottom of the priority list. And the fact of the matter is, that is, all of these fellas are out here running to get elected, and they say we're going to get out of the war. If you want to be sure that we will get out of the war, you better elect me president. Because you see, I am not espoused by labor interests, by military industrial complex interests, by corporate interests, by banking interests. He who pays the piper calls the tune. That is why people are distrusting our politicians, because by the time they get to the White House, they have to take care of other interests first before they begin to take care of the interests of the American people. I am the only real people's politician running for this important office. I'm not hooked into any kind of groups. I don't have to call top-level conferences or have long-distance telephone calls to do what has to be done in terms of what my conscience tells me must be done to do something about the malaise that creeps across this land. Because I'm not hooked into anybody. The fact of the matter is, when I went into the Appalachia region of this country and went in and saw how some of the poor whites were living, it was such a surprise for them to see me coming out of a two-seater plane to see them. And that was before I decided to run for president. I want you to know how deeply committed I am to humanity. I didn't suddenly go out there because I'm running for president. I've been visiting with the Indians and these people for years now. And to go out there and to see how these people are living. The reason they're surprised is that I'm a black woman. And secondly, they haven't seen a politician in 50 years, but they vote for politicians every two and every 4 years. But why should they see a politician? Because they're not really important. Nobody cares about them. And for me to go and say to them, what difference does it make if you are white and the people down the block from you are black? Both of you are living in homes with dirt floors. Look, you don't have even wooden floors. So you're white and they're black. So what's the difference? Both of you still don't get two or three good meals a day. So you're white and they're black. And both of you lack modern plumbing sanitary facilities. So you're white and they're black. Both of you are have-nots. You better get together. Man's humanity to man has gone right out the window in this country. It has been going out for a long time, but we are now at the peak of man's humanity to man. Never before in this country since the inception of the Republic have you seen so many segments of this society simultaneously lashing out at something or somebody. Everybody's mad. Blacks have roared out of their slumber asking for their unequivocal share of the American dream that everybody has been mouthing and frothing for time immemorial. The Indians are now saying, look, this is my land too. Get me off this reservation or I stake out my claims in other places in this country. The Taconis are saying, look, don't come giving me any more rhetoric about the multifaceted society and democracy and what have you. Give me a wage that I can live and keep my family together. The young people of this country are fed up with a lot of the values and the priorities in a nation that says it's a multifaceted society. It believes in the brotherhood of man, the concept of democracy, and all of the beautiful things written in our Declaration of Independence in our United States Constitution, and yet today, nothing but rhetoric and frothings and gibberish every 4 years. Yes, I tell it like it is. It's got to be told like it is because we have been operating in this country under the basis of so much sham and hypocrisy, and it is catching up with us real fast. And the American people wanting out of this war, and look at you. Just look at you, marching till you're crazy. Having all kinds of moratoriums and vigils, doing everything possible, and yet they don't hear us. It means that they don't really have to listen to you because you have not made politics important enough in your lives. Like the Swedes and the English and the Italians get all excited about their politics. You haven't made it important enough to begin to start doing something about it on the local level and on the state level and pulling out all those congressmen who are constantly helping to give the authorizations and appropriations for the continuation of this Holocaust in Vietnam. You have abdicated your citizenship rights and responsibility because you're fed up. You have said it's no use. I don't want to be bothered with the system. So therefore, by abdicating that, you get what you deserve. You have the power. You have the power to change it, let me tell you. And particularly you 18 to 21-year-olds now, don't go out here, for heaven's sakes, and just give your vote to somebody because he's a good Democrat, or he's handsome, or he talks nicely, or he'll do this and do it. Study the record. Study the record of these men for the past 8 years, if you will, to see if they have this commitment that they're all talking about, and you will find that they really don't have this commitment if you take time to study the record for 8 or 10 years. But what you do, you get caught up with how the jingles and the slogans are put together and how the people supporting certain candidates come into the community and open up all the storefronts and everything that goes with a regular political game. And you get caught. You go along. If you go along, that's your business. Every man and woman in this country who can vote has a right to cast their ballot for the individual that they really believe will guide this ship of state in terms of the direction that it needs to be guided. And I can tell you fully well, without being modest about it at all, that if I were not black, and I were not a woman, and I was a white male, I would get much more attention in terms of what I'm doing in this country at this hour. But c'est la vie. To look at the position of this country in terms of the espousal of equalitarian principles. Millions of dollars of taxpayers' money going abroad for economic and or financial assistance to prop up a bunch of military dictatorships who are repressing and suppressing the personal liberties of their own citizens within their own borders. Espousal of equalitarian principles. You know, we get away with a lot of verbal Tommy rot in our country. What happens to these equalitarian principles in terms of other peoples abroad when the dollar gets in the way? You know what happens, and I know what happens. When I become president, I'm not going to say if, when I become president, I would cut off every bit of your money, not my money, your money, to countries that are propping up these dictatorships and repressing and suppressing their own peoples. That is if you believe in democracy. That is if you believe in democracy. A lot of the others talk about it, but they can't do it. That's another story. You look at our country in the United Nations. The whole question of the Rhodesian sanctions that everybody else is following except us. The whole question of South Africa constantly being ruled, a majority being ruled by a white minority. Repression such as you've never seen it and never believed it in your life. And what do we do in the United Nations? We abstain or we vote negatively and we espouse democratic principles. The hypocrisy. Now you can really understand why the corporate interests wouldn't back me. Why the banking interests wouldn't back me. Do you see the interconnection? Therefore, you can understand why the establishment would never want to see a person like me in the White House. Because I tell you, the first thing when we get into that White House, if we have a commitment to the multifacetedness of America, the first thing would be it would no longer be the White House. It would be the polka dot house. The dream that everyone speaks about must become a reality, young people. Don't you follow what your mothers and your fathers and the older generation have been doing, constantly mouthing the words about the dream and not helping it to become a reality, young people. You're going to be taking over the guidance of this country in the future. Please have a gut commitment to the dream becoming a reality before it is too late. The time has come in this country when we must have a government that's reflective of all of the different segments of America. What's wrong with a black person for vice president? An Indian for the head of the Department of Interior, and a woman for the head of HEW. What's wrong with it? That is a multifaceted society. That is the dream come true. Although I'm literally and figuratively the dark horse, I think I'm beginning to help give a few ponies a push. This morning I see a particular candidate, all of a sudden he's going to have a Mexican-American in his cabinet. Stealing my thunder. Fantastic. I want to say these things to you in conclusion. Oh, there's so many things I'd like to say to you. It would take me about 3 hours. I want to teach you. I'm a teacher by profession. There's so many things I'd like to teach you. But let me say this. The next 2 weeks in California, there's going to be a lot of hitting below the belt. Because over 250 votes are at stake in this state. And they have the feeling and the idea that, for example, if Shirley Chisholm gets out of the California primary because she can't win, she gets out, that one of the two so-called front runners will have it locked up more or less, and the convention would be a fait accompli before we get to Miami. No more of that. The American people, for the first time this year, are going to have the opportunity to go to that convention and actually participate. For the first time in this country, you're going to have a convention that's representative of the American people. There are going to be lots of black folks there, lots of women folk, lots of young folk. Do you know that prior to this time, the convention was usually 70% white male, 50 years of age or over, and that was the convention that selected the president? But now that we have this broadened base, all of a sudden, they're not too interested. You see, they give you the appeasement. They're not too concerned about people going to the convention and still actually participating. They want it to be a fait accompli before you get there. And so you pay your plane fare, and you pay for your hotel rent, and you pay for your food. And when you get there, you have the feeling that you're participating when you're not participating in nothing, just going through ritual. Well, I tell you something. Who want to vote for me? Vote for me. Let the people make their choice in California on January 6th. Where do they get the idea that either GMCG or HHH is going to be the nominee? There was another gentleman that was frightening everybody a while back. He had a lot of big name endorsers. And a lot of money in back of him. The thing that they say you need to get across the top. Big name endorsers and money. And something happened to him on his way to the White House. Now, don't any of you sit in this room and think that because these so-called two front runners have it sold up. I'm the national committee woman from the state of New York, and I'm sitting in on a lot of things, and I can tell you it's all but sold up. It's not sold up. And it's not going to be sold up. That's why they want me out of this race. I am not going any place. Same old story. Last hired, first fired. When I got into this race, even at the very beginning, young people, Even when I was peaking number two in many of the regional caucuses in the northeastern section of this country, they had the nerve to tell me, you are breaking up the liberal vote. You're going to get Nixon back in the White House. Why don't you get out? And even when McCarthy and John Lindsay weren't peaking in some areas the way I was speaking, they never asked one of the two of them to get out, because it's the same old story in America. If you're not white and if you're not male, you have no right to be in any kind of race. But I tell you, I intend to be in this race in California because I want change. I don't want anybody talking to me about any more change. I want change. I want to put the liberals on the line, if you will. And whether or not I'm able to secure the nomination, the fact of the matter is to be able to go to that convention and to know that so many thousand people in the state of California wanted Shirley Chisholm to be the new kind of leader in this country. That will give me the strength in terms of saying to the big boys, you know, this is my following. Because we're not going to elect anybody's president at the Democratic convention on the first two or three ballots. Let me tell you that. All of us are going to be there maneuvering and negotiating and what have you. But they want to put it together very fast. They must put it together very fast. Because two things, two bits of information have come out. And it's coming from the southern part of this country. All of these blacks and all of these women coming to the convention, what are we going to do? They must control the convention before it actually gets underway, because they don't know what they're going to do with all these blacks and all of these women who are not hooked into their political patronage system. Don't you see what they're trying to do? So I say to you, if you want change and you don't want business as usual, you will give me a chance on June 6th here in California. Remember, it took a little black woman to bring 300 of her people out of bondage. It took another little black woman a few years ago just to get up and say that she was sick and tired of going to the back of the bus, and she caused a certain thrust in the civil rights movement of this nation. Strange as it may seem, it may just take a black woman to bring all of us together.
Yes. You're great.
Thank you. Thank you very much. thank you so much. I would like to say thank you so much, and I'd like to give you an opportunity to ask a few questions. So the microphone's on either side, and I'll get some water meanwhile. You do that. The questions that you ask do not necessarily have to pertain to the remarks that I've just shared with you.
Is this mic on? There's one thing, one basic thing that puzzles me about everything that you talked about. It's a thing that you seem to have in common with all the rest of the candidates, especially in the Democratic Party, and that is not talking much about the nature of that institution. And in an institution that's filled with people like Wallace and Chicken Maddox and Shoot the Kill Daily and E.C. Mott himself, the father of General Motors, and a Clark Clifford who's on the social register, and with all kinds of studies being done by the nature of that institution being a terribly undemocratic institution run from the top with contradictions throughout it and tailor-made to maintain the status quo, a kind of thing that Malcolm referred to when talking about the Democratic Party, as a chicken that can't lay duck eggs. You cannot change an institution that is handmade to oppress people, that is run undemocratically from the top and is full of racists, sexists, and bigots and exploiters. And I don't understand how you propose, given the way that party is organized and the way it runs, to make any change. What are you doing in the Democratic Party?
Strange as it may seem, although I'm a part of a minority, an oppressed and repressed minority in this country, I do not measure this country by its achievements, young man. Never have. I measure this country by its potential. I still think that this country can be made to be more responsive, but we have not been able to have the kind of shaking up and turning around that is necessary. So I'm doing my own thing in my own way. I'm not saying I'm going to be continuing on this path forever, but I'm willing to believe in terms of a lot of things that I have not shared with you this afternoon, that you're going to see some very interesting things occurring at the convention in Miami this July. All of the action will take place within the hall, not outside of the hall. Another thing, you have all kinds of splinter groups in our country saying that, you know, the two-party system is no good, it's dead, and in a sense it is dying. But why don't all of these splinter groups in this country then, therefore, come together with some kind of basic program or basic reformation that the masses will adhere to? You can't have any kind of structure, any kind of institution supposedly being put together for the poor or the masses unless you're pretty sure that the poor and the masses are going to accept what it is that you're offering. And the history of this country has been indicating and showing me that this hasn't happened yet. But maybe it can happen. This is the challenge. Will all of these splinter groups then on the outside now come together and do something about the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in terms of coming forth with an entirely new kind of institution or new kind of party or what have you? That is the challenge. Because people are not just going to follow people because they're talking loud or because they say that this is no good, it's rotten, it's this, it's that. They've heard that song before. I think what is important, are we who are dissatisfied and disgruntled and upset about the two-party system and more specifically the Democratic Party, you've been mentioning it to me, are we ready to call together, to call a nationwide convention of all of the different splinter groups that are all over this country, the different parties that are running their own candidates, and say, no, look, you and I don't see eye to eye. We have differences of opinion, but can we minimize our own following? Can we minimize our own leadership and put some maximum input into coming up with something that the masses and the people out here are going to say, yes, this is it, we're going with them? That is the challenge. You can't do it any other way. I've been asked by several other splinter groups that are running candidates, what are you doing in this? Why don't you run for us? Why don't you? I've been asked by four other groups to consider running, and yet four other groups, so what? You've had nothing but splinter groups at conventions running their own candidates and what have you. I'm 47 years of age. I'm not about to go on any more futility trips. Ever since I've been here, wait a minute, don't clap, wait a minute. Before I got into politics, I was on a lot of trips. All futile. And now that I am 47, and maybe I'm a little bit too old, you tell me I'm too old, ain't much hope for me, I'll be willing to accept it. But I'm not about to go on any more of those futile trips. I'm willing to see if, in my own way, what I can't do. And there is, I've said over and over again, I have a few Trump cards that I'm not releasing to anybody. And I'm going to see if I can do what it is I have in mind at the convention. And then after the convention is over, you know, I'm not shy, I'll tell you what I'm going to do next. You can't go about asking people to follow you or to change unless you say to the people, now this is why you must change. A, this is the economic program I have. B, this is the social program I have. C, This is the political program I have. People aren't going to change for change's sake. People want change. There's no doubt they want change in America, want it badly. But we haven't yet been able to come up with some kind of massive movement as such that the masses out here will say, we are ready to go, we're ready to move. That is the biggest challenge to all of us. After this convention is over, I have some other things in mind. Okay? You know, it may not satisfy you, but I got to tell it to you the way I see it. I just don't want any more futile trips. And it could take me hours to tell you about some of these futile trips that I and a few of my people have been on in this country.
Are we taking four questions?
Yes. I hope to have anywhere from 50 to 65. Let me tell you how I arrive at that figure. Right now I have 18 committed votes. In the uncommitted delegation, uncommitted delegates, I have quite a large number that I don't want to release, but I have quite a large number. Wallace peaked in Florida. He made his thrust in Florida. Humphrey made his thrust in Pennsylvania. Muskie made his thrust in New Hampshire. I haven't made my thrust yet, because the thrust that I will be making are in two states that have late primaries. I'll be picking up the majority of my delegates in my own state on June 20th, the very last primary, and a number in New Jersey on June 6th. That is why I come to this.
Oh, that was quite an earful that we got from Shirley Chisholm, speaking at UCLA in 1972, the same year that she was running for President of the United States. So, you might have heard many familiar themes that I've talked about here and that we've talked about on Lead Stories. And hopefully they will resurface in greater depth tomorrow when we have our Free Your Mind Friday session. But quite an interesting backdrop to the understanding of politics, our role in politics, as she said, that we ought to reconsider our role in politics. And she talked about race. She talked, with all of her qualifications and so forth, she talked about what really matters in terms of qualifications for running for an office, the highest office in the land. Quite interesting. Well, we'll pick that up again tomorrow, but I do hope that you enjoyed hearing from her and hearing her own take, her own analysis of what's going on in the country, how she viewed the world, and how the world viewed her. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, and you can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. Thanks for listening. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.